Chapter 55. Rome saw at once that the very existence of the United States was a formidable menace to her own life. From the very beginning, she perfidiously sowed the germs of division and hatred between the two great sections of this country, and succeeded in dividing South from North on the burning question of slavery. That division was her golden opportunity to crush one by the other and reign over the bloody ruins of both, a favored long-standing policy. She hoped that the hour of her supreme triumph over this continent was come. She ordered the Emperor of France to be ready with an army in Mexico, ready to support the South, and she made all Roman Catholics to enroll themselves under the banners of slavery by joining themselves to the Democratic Party. Only one bishop dared to disobey. Above everything, the order was handed down to oppose the election of Lincoln at all costs. The Democratic press, almost entirely under Roman Catholic control, and a devoted tool of the Jesuits, deluged the country with the most fearful denunciations. They called him an ape, a stupid brute, a most dangerous lunatic, a bloody monster, a merciless tyrant, etc., etc. Rome ransacked the English dictionary to find the most suitable expressions to fill the people with contempt, hatred, and horror against him. But God decreed that honest Abraham Lincoln should be proclaimed President of the United States the 4th of March, 1861. At the end of August, I learned from a Roman Catholic priest whom, by the mercy of God, I had persuaded to leave the errors of popery, that there was a plot among them to assassinate the president. I thought it was my duty to go and tell him what I knew. He received me with greatest cordiality and kindness. "I am so glad to meet you again," he said. "You see that your friends, the Jesuits, have not yet killed me, but they would have surely done it when I passed through their most devoted city, Baltimore, had I not passed by incognito a few hours before they expected me. We have proof that the company which had been selected and organized to murder me was led by a rabid Roman Catholic called Byron. It was almost entirely composed of Roman Catholics. More than that, there were two disguised priests among them to lead and encourage them. I am sorry to have so little time to see you, but I will not let you go before telling you that a few days ago I saw Mr. Morse, the learned inventor of electric telegraphy. He told me that when he was in Rome not long ago, he found out the proofs of a most formidable conspiracy against this country and all its institutions. It is evident that it is to the intrigues and emissaries of the Pope that we owe in great part the horrible civil war which is threatening to cover the country with blood and ruins. I am sorry that Professor Morse had to leave Rome before he could know more about the secret plans of the Jesuits against the liberties and the very existence of this country. But do you know that I want you to take his place and continue that investigation? My plan is to attach you to my ambassador of France as one of the secretaries. In that honorable position, you would go from Paris to Rome, where you might find through the directions of Mr. Morris, an opportunity of reuniting the broken threads of his researches. It takes a Greek to find a Greek. As you have been 25 years a priest of Rome, I do not know any man in the United States so well acquainted as you are with the tricks of the Jesuits, and on whom I could better rely. What do you think of that? My dear President, I answered, I feel overwhelmed by your kindness. Surely nothing could be more pleasant to me than to grant your request. The honor you want to confer upon me is much above my merit, but my conscience tells me that I cannot give up the preaching of the gospel to my poor French Canadian countrymen. I feel that I am the servant, the ambassador of one who is above even the good and great President of the United States. I appeal to your own Christian and honorable feelings to know if I can forsake the one for the other. The President became very solemn and replied, You are right. There is nothing so great under heaven as to be the ambassador of Christ. Then, with one of his fine jokes, he said, Yes, yes, you are the ambassador of a greater prince than I am. But he does not pay you with so good cash as I would do. He then added, I am exceedingly pleased to see you. However, I am so pressed by most important affairs. Could you please come again tomorrow at 10 o'clock? I have a very important question to ask you on a matter which has been constantly before my mind these last few weeks. The next day, at the appointed hour, my noble friend said, I could not give you more than 10 minutes yesterday, but I will give you 20 today. I want your views about a thing which is exceedingly puzzling to me, and you are the only one to whom I like to speak on that subject. A great number of democratic papers, evidently written by Roman Catholics, published that I was born a Roman Catholic and baptized by a priest. They call me a renegade, an apostate, and they heap upon my head mountains of abuses. At first I laughed at that, for it is a lie. Thanks be to God, I have never been a Roman Catholic. No priest of Rome has ever laid his hand on my head. But their persistency in this falsehood must have a meaning. Please tell me what you think. My dear President, I answered, it was just this strange story which brought me here yesterday. I wept as a child when I read it, for the first time, for I believe that it is your sentence of death, and I have from the lips of a converted priest that they have invented this falsehood to excite the fanaticism of the Roman Catholic murderers whom they hope to find sooner or later to strike you down. They want to brand your face with the ignominious mark of apostasy. In the Church of Rome, an apostate is an outcast who has no place in society and no right to live. I have brought to you the theology of one of the most learned and approved of the Jesuits of his time, Busenbaum, who, with many others, say, The man who will kill you will do a good and holy work. More than that, here is a copy of a decree of Gregory VII, proclaiming that the killing of an apostate, as you are declared to be, is not murder, nay, that it is a Christian action. That decree is incorporated in the canon law, which every priest must study and which every good Catholic must follow. My dear President, I must repeat what I said at Urbana in 1856. I fear you will fall under the blows of a Jesuit assassin if you do not pay more attention to protect yourself. Remember that because Coligny was a heretic as you are, He was brutally murdered in the St. Bartholomew night. That Henry IV was stabbed by the Jesuit assassin Revillac the 14th of May, 1610, for having given liberty of conscience to his people, and that William the Taciturn was shot dead by another Jesuit murderer called Gerard for having broken the yoke of the Pope. The Church of Rome is absolutely the same and does believe and teach today as then that she has the right and duty to punish by death any heretic who is an obstacle to her designs. The Catholic hierarchy of the United States is on the side of the rebels, as incontrovertible evidence that Rome wants to destroy this republic. You are, by your personal virtues, your popularity, your love for liberty, your position, the greatest obstacle to their diabolical schemes. Their hatred is consecrated upon you. My blood chills when I contemplate the day when Rome will add to all her other iniquities the murder of Abraham Lincoln. When saying these things to the President, I was exceedingly moved. My voice was choked, and I could hardly retain my tears. But the President was perfectly calm. When I had finished speaking, he took the volume of Busbaum from my hand and read the lines which I had marked with red, and I helped him to translate them into English. He then gave me back the book and said, "I will repeat to you what I said at Urbana. Man must not care where and when he will die, provided he dies at the post of honor and duty. But I may add today that I have presentiment that God will call me to him through the hand of an assassin. Let his will and not mine be done." He then looked at his watch and said, "I am sorry that the 20 minutes I had consecrated to our interview have almost passed away. I will be forever grateful for the warning words you have addressed to me about the dangers ahead to my life from Rome. I know that they are not imaginary dangers. If I were fighting against a Protestant South as a nation, there would be no danger of assassination. The nations who read the Bible fight bravely on the battlefields, but they do not assassinate their enemies. The Pope and the Jesuits, with their infernal Inquisition, are the only organized powers in the world which have recourse to the dagger of the assassin to murder those whom they cannot convince with their arguments or conquer with the sword. Unfortunately, I feel more and more every day that it is not against the Americans of the South alone I am fighting. It is more against the Pope of Rome, his perfidious Jesuits, and their blind and bloodthirsty slaves. As long as they hope to conquer the North, they will spare me. But the day we rout their armies, take their cities, and force them to submit, then it is my impression that the Jesuits, who are the principal rulers of the South, will do what they have almost invariably done in the past. The dagger or the pistol will do what the strong hands of the warriors could not achieve. This civil war seems to be nothing but a political affair to those who do not see, as I do, the secret springs of that terrible drama. But it is more a religious than a civil war. It is Rome who wants to rule and degrade the North as she ruled and degraded the South from the very day of its discovery. There are only very few of the Southern leaders who are not more or less under the influence of the Jesuits. Through their wives, family relations, and their friends, several members of the family of Jeff Davis belong to the Church of Rome. Even the Protestant ministers are under the influence of the Jesuits without suspecting it, to keep her ascendancy in the north as she does in the south. Rome is doing here what she has done in Mexico and in all the South American republics. She is paralyzing by civil war the arms of the soldiers of liberty. She divides our nation in order to weaken, subdue, and rule it. Surely we have some brave and reliable Roman Catholic officers and soldiers in our armies, but they form an insignificant minority when compared with the Roman Catholic traitors against whom we have to guard ourselves day and night. The fact is that the immense majority of Roman Catholic bishops, priests, and laymen are rebels in heart, when they cannot be in fact, with very few exceptions, they are publicly in favor of slavery. I understand now why the patriots of France, who determined to see the colors of liberty floating over their great and beautiful country, were forced to hang or shoot almost all the priests and the monks as the irreconcilable enemies of liberty. For it is now evident to me that with very few exceptions, every priest and every true Roman Catholic is a determined enemy of liberty. Their extermination in France was one of the most terrible necessities which no human wisdom could avoid. It looks to me now as an order from heaven to save France. May God grant that the same terrible necessity be never felt in the United States, but it is very certain that if the American people could learn what I know of the fierce hatred of the priests of Rome against our institutions, our schools, our most sacred rights, and our so dearly bought liberties, they would drive them away tomorrow from among us, or they would shoot them as traitors. But you are the only one to whom I reveal these sad secrets, for I know that you learned them before me. The history of these last 1,000 years tells us that wherever the Church of Rome is not a dagger to pierce the bosom of a free nation, she is a stone to her neck to paralyze her and prevent her advance in the ways of civilization, science, intelligence, happiness, and liberty. But I forgot that my 20 minutes are gone long ago. Please accept my sincere thanks for the new light you have given me on the dangers of my position, and come again. I will always see you with a new pleasure. My second visit to Abraham Lincoln was at the beginning of June 1862, but I found him so busy that I could only shake hands with him. The third and last time I went to pay my respects to the doomed president was on the morning of June 8, 1864, when he was absolutely besieged by people who wanted to see him. After a kind and warm shaking of hands, he said, "I am much pleased to see you again, but it is impossible today to say anything more than this. Tomorrow afternoon I will receive the delegation of the deputies of all the loyal states sent to officially announce the desire of the country that I should remain the president 4 more years. I invite you to be present with them at that interesting meeting. You will see some of the most prominent men of our republic, and I will be glad to introduce you to them. You will not present yourself as a delegate of the people, but only as the guest of the president. And that there may be no troubles, I will give you this card with a permit to enter the delegation. But do not leave Washington before I see you again. I have some important matters on which I want to know your mind." The next day it was my privilege to have the greatest honor ever received by me. The good president wanted me to stand at his right hand when he received the delegation, and hear the address presented by Governor Dennison, the president of the convention, to which he replied in his own admirable simplicity and eloquence, finishing by one of his most witty anecdotes. I am reminded in this convention of a story of an old Dutch farmer who remarked to a companion wisely that it was not best to swap horses when crossing a stream. The next day he took me with him to visit the 30,000 wounded soldiers picked up on the battlefield of the 7 days' battle of the Wilderness and the 30 days' battle around Richmond, where Grant was just breaking the backbone of the rebellion. On the way to and from the hospitals, little was said. The noise of the carriage was too great. Besides, my soul was very distressed. The horrors of this fanatical, fratricidal war had stifled my voice. The only thought which seemed to occupy the mind of the president was the part which Rome had in that horrible struggle. Many times he repeated, "This war would never have been possible without the sinister influence of the Jesuits. We owe it to Popery that we now see our land reddened with the blood of our noblest sons. Though there were great differences of opinion between the South and the North on the question of slavery, neither Jeff Davis nor any of the leading men of the Confederacy would have dared to attack the North had they not relied on the promises of the Jesuits that under the mask of democracy, the money and arms of the Roman Catholics, even the arms of France, were at their disposal, if they would attack us. I pity the priests, the bishops, and the monks of Rome in the United States, when the people realize that they are in great part responsible for the tears and the blood shed in this war. I conceal that I know, for if the people knew the whole truth, this war would turn into a religious war and at once take a tenfold more savage and bloody character. It would become merciless, as all religious wars are. It would become a war of extermination on both sides. The Protestants of both the North and the South would surely unite to exterminate the priests and the Jesuits if they could hear what Professor Morris has said to me of the plots made in the very city of Rome to destroy this republic, and if they could learn how the priests, the nuns, and the monks, which daily land on our shores under the pretext of preaching their religion, instructing the people in their schools, taking care of the sick in the hospitals, are nothing else but the emissaries of the Pope, of Napoleon, and the other despots of Europe, to undermine our institutions, alienate the hearts of our people from our Constitution and our laws, destroy our schools, and prepare a reign of anarchy here, as they have done in Ireland, in Mexico, in Spain, and wherever there are any people who want to be free." When the president was speaking thus, we arrived at the door of his mansion. He invited me to go with him to his study, and said, "Though I am very busy, there are many important things about the plots of the Jesuits that I can learn only from you. Have you read the letter of the Pope to Jeff Davis, and what do you think of it?" "My dear President," I answered, "it is just that letter which brought me to your presence again. That letter is a poisoned arrow thrown by the Pope at you personally. It is your death warrant. Before the letter, every Catholic could see that the Church as a whole was against this free republic. However, a good number of liberty-loving Irish, German, and French Catholics, following more the instincts of their noble nature than the degrading principles of their Church, enrolled themselves under the banners of liberty, and they have fought like heroes. To detach these men from the rank and file of the northern armies and force them to help the cause of the rebellion became the object of the Jesuits. Secret pressing letters were addressed from Rome to the bishops, ordering them to weaken your armies by detaching those men from you. The bishops refused, for they would be exposing themselves as traitors and be shot. But they advised the Pope to acknowledge at once the legitimacy of the Southern Republic and to take Jeff Davis under his supreme protection by a letter which would be read everywhere. That letter tells every Roman Catholic that you are a bloodthirsty tyrant fighting against a government which the infallible and holy Pope of Rome recognizes as legitimate. The Pope, by this letter, tells his blind slaves that you are outraging the God of heaven and earth by continuing such a bloody struggle. By this letter of the Pope to Jeff Davis, you are not only an apostate as you were thought before, whom every man had the right to kill, according to the canonical laws of Rome, but you are more vile, criminal, and cruel than the horse thief, the public bandit, and the lawless brigand, robber, and murderer. And my dear President, this is not a fancy imagination on my part. It is the unanimous explanation given me by a great number of the priests of Rome with whom I have had occasion to speak on that subject. In the name of God and in the name of our dear country, which is in so much need of your services, I plead that you to pay more attention to protect your precious life and not continue to expose it as you have done till now. The President listened to my words with breathless attention. He replied, "You confirm my views of the letter of the Pope. Professor Morris is of the same mind. It is indeed the most perfidious act which could occur under present circumstances. You are perfectly correct when you say it was to detach the Roman Catholics who had enrolled themselves in our armies. Since the publication of that letter, a great number of them have deserted their banners and turned traitor. One of the few who have not is Sheridan, worth a whole army by his ability, his patriotism, and his heroic courage. It is true also, that Meade has remained with us and gained the bloody Battle of Gettysburg. But how could he lose it when he was surrounded by such heroes as Howard, Reynolds, Buford, Wadsworth, Cutler, Slocum, Sickles, Hancock, Barnes, etc. But it is evident that his Romanism superseded his patriotism after the battle. He let the army of Lee escape when he could easily have cut his retreat and forced him to surrender after losing nearly the half of his soldiers in the last 3 days' carnage. When Meade was to order the pursuit after the battle, a stranger came in haste to the headquarters, and that stranger was a disguised Jesuit. After 10 minutes' conversation with him, Meade made such arrangements for the pursuit of the enemy that he escaped almost untouched with the loss of only 2 guns. You are right, continued the President, that this letter of the Pope has entirely changed the nature and the ground of the war. Before they read it, the Roman Catholics could see that I was fighting against Jeff Davis and the Southern Confederacy, but now they must believe that it is against Christ and his holy vicar, the Pope, that I am raising my sacrilegious hands. We have the daily proofs that their indignation, their hatred, their malice against me are 100-fold intensified. New projects of assassination are detected almost every day, accompanied with such savage circumstances that they bring to my memory the massacre of St. Bartholomew and the gunpowder plot. Our investigation indicates that they come from the same masters in the art of murder, the Jesuits. The New York riots were evidently a Romish plot from beginning to end. We have the proofs in hand that they were the work of Bishop Hughes and his emissaries. No doubt can remain about the bloody attempts of Rome to destroy New York, when we know the easy way it was stopped. I wrote to Bishop Hughes, telling him that the whole country would hold him responsible for it if he would not stop it at once. He then gathered the rioters around his palace, called them his dear friends, invited them to go back home peacefully, and all was finished. So Jupiter of old used to raise a storm and stop it with a nod of his head. From the beginning of our civil war, there has been not a secret, but a public alliance between the Pope of Rome and Jeff Davis. The Pope and his Jesuits have advised, supported, and directed Jeff Davis on the land from the first gun shot at Fort Sumter by the rabid Roman Catholic Borough Guard. They are helping him on the sea by guiding and supporting the rabid Roman Catholic pirate Seams on the ocean. In my interview with Bishop Hughes, I told him that every stranger who had sworn allegiance to our government by becoming a United States citizen like himself was liable to be shot or hung as a traitor and a spy. After I had put this plea in the ears of the Romish bishop, I requested him to go and report my words to the Pope. My hope was that he would advise them for their own interests to become loyal and true to their allegiance and help us through the remaining part of the war. But the result has been the very contrary. The Pope has thrown away the mask and shown himself the public partisan and the protector of the rebellion by taking Jeff Davis by the hand and impudently recognizing the southern states as a legitimate government. Now, I have the proof in hand that that very Bishop Hughes, whom I had sent to Rome to induce the Pope to urge the Roman Catholics of the North at least to be true to their oath of allegiance, and whom I thanked publicly when under the impression that he had acted honestly according to the promise he had given me, is the very man who advised the Pope to recognize the legitimacy of the Southern Republic and put the whole weight of his tiara in the balance against us in favor of our enemies. Such is the perfidy of those Jesuits. Two cankers are biting the very entrails of the United States today: the Romish and the Mormon priests. Both are equally at work to form a people of the most abject, ignorant, and fanatical slaves, who will recognize no other authority but their supreme pontiffs. Both are aiming at the destruction of our schools, to raise themselves upon our ruins. Both shelter themselves under our grand and holy principles of liberty of conscience, to destroy that very liberty of conscience and bind the world under their heavy and ignominious yoke. The Mormon and the Jesuit priest are equally the uncompromising enemies of our Constitution and our laws. But the more dangerous of the two is the Jesuit, the Romish priest, for he knows better how to conceal his hatred under the mask of friendship and public good. He is better trained to commit the most cruel and diabolical deeds for the glory of God. Till lately, I was in favor of the unlimited liberty of conscience as our Constitution gives it to the Roman Catholics. But now, it seems to me that sooner or later the people will be forced to put a restriction to that clause toward the Papists. Is it not an act of folly to give absolute liberty of conscience to a set of men who are publicly sworn to cut our throats the very day they have the opportunity? Is it right to give the privilege of citizenship to men who are sworn and public enemies of our Constitution, our laws, our liberties, and our lives? The very moment that Popery assumed the right of life and death on a citizen of France, Spain, Germany, England, or the United States, it assumed to be the power, the government of France, Spain, England, Germany, and the United States. Those states then committed a suicidal act by allowing Popery to put a foot on their territory with the privilege of citizenship. The power to life and death is the supreme power, and two supreme powers cannot exist on the same territory without anarchy, riots, bloodshed, and civil wars without end. When Popery will give up the power of life and death, which it proclaims as its own divine power, to all its theological books and canon laws, then and then alone it can be tolerated and can receive the privilege of citizenship in a free country. Is it not an absurdity to give to a man a thing which he has sworn to hate, curse, and destroy? And does not the Catholic Church of Rome hate, curse, and destroy liberty of conscience whenever she can do it safely? I am for liberty of conscience in its noblest, broadest, highest sense, but I cannot give liberty of conscience to the Pope and to his followers, the Papists, so long as they tell me, through all their councils, theologians, and canon laws, that their conscience orders them to burn my wife, strangle my children, and cut my throat when they find their opportunity. This does not seem to be understood by the people today, but sooner or later, the light of common sense will make it clear to everyone that no liberty of conscience can be granted to men who are sworn to obey a pope who pretends to have the right to put to death those who differ from him in religion. You are not the first to warn me against the dangers of assassination. My ambassadors in Italy, France, and England, as well as Professor Morris, have many times warned me against the plots of the murderers which they have detected in those different countries. But I see no other safeguard against those murderers but to be always ready to die, as Christ advises it, as we must all die sooner or later. It makes very little difference to me whether I die from a dagger plunged through my heart or from an inflammation of the lungs. Let me tell you, I have lately read a passage in the Old Testament which had made a profound, and I hope a salutary impression on me. Here is the passage. The president took his Bible, opened it at the third chapter of Deuteronomy, and read from the 22nd and 28th verse. Ye shall not fear them, for the Lord your God, he shall fight for you. And I besought the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, thou hast begun to show thy servant thy greatness and thy mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or in earth that can do according to thy words and according to thy might? I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land that is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain in Lebanon. But the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes, and would not hear me. And the Lord said unto me, Let it suffice thee, speak no more unto me of this matter. Get thee up unto the top of Pisgah, and lift up thine eyes westward, and northward, and southward, and eastward, and behold it with thine eyes, for thou shalt not go over this Jordan. After the president had read these words with great solemnity, he added, My dear Father Tenequi, let me tell you that I have read these strange and beautiful verses several times these last 5 or 6 weeks. The more I read them, the more it seems to me that God has written them for me as well as Moses. Has he not taken me from my poor log cabin by the hand as he did Moses in the reeds of the Nile, to put me at the head of the greatest and the most blessed of modern nations, just as he put that prophet at the head of the most blessed nation of ancient times? Has not God granted me a privilege which was not granted to any living man when I broke the fetters of 4 million men and made them free? Has not God given me the most glorious victories over our enemies? Are not the armies of the Confederacy so reduced to a handful of men when compared to what they were 2 years ago, that the day is fast approaching when they will have to surrender? Now, I see the end of this terrible conflict with the same joy of Moses at the end of his 40 years in the wilderness. I pray my God to grant me to see the days of peace and untold prosperity which will follow this cruel war, as Moses asked God to see the other side of Jordan and enter the promised land. But do you know that I hear in my soul as the voice of God giving me the rebuke which he was given to Moses? Yes, every time that my soul goes to God to ask the favor of seeing the other side of Jordan and eating the fruits of that peace, after which I am longing with such an unspeakable desire, do you know that there is a still but solemn voice which tells me that I will see those things only from a long distance, and that I will be among the dead when the nation which God granted me to lead through those awful trials will cross the Jordan and dwell in that land of promise, where peace, industry, happiness, and liberty will make everyone happy? And why so? Because he has already given me favors which he never gave, I dare say, to any man in these latter days. Why did God Almighty refuse to Moses the favor of crossing the Jordan and entering the promised land? It was account of his own nation's sin. That law of divine retribution and justice by which one must suffer for another is surely a terrible mystery, but it is a fact which no man who has any intelligence and knowledge can deny. Moses, who knew that law, though he probably did not understand it better than we do, calmly says to his people, "God was wroth with me for your sakes." But though we do not understand that mysterious and terrible law, we find it written in letters of tears and blood wherever we go. We do not read a single page of history without finding undeniable traces of its existence. So many plots have already been laid against my life that it is a real miracle that they have all failed, when we consider that the great majority of them were in the hands of the skillful Roman Catholic murderers, evidently trained by Jesuits. But can we expect that God will make a perpetual miracle to save my life? I believe not. The Jesuits are so expert in those deeds of blood that Henry IV said that it was impossible to escape them, and he became their victim, though he did all that could be done to protect himself. My escape from their hands, since the letter of the Pope to Jeff Davis has sharpened a million daggers to pierce my breast, would be more than a miracle. But just as the Lord heard no murmur from the lips of Moses when he told him that he had to die before crossing the Jordan for the sins of his people, so I hope and pray that he will hear no murmur from me when I fall for my nation's sake. The only two favors I ask of the Lord are, first, that I may die for the sacred cause in which I am engaged, and when I am the standard-bearer of the rights and liberties of my country. The second favor I ask of God is that my dear son Robert, when I am gone, will be one of those who lift up that flag of liberty which will cover my tomb and carry it with honor and fidelity to the end of his life as his father did, surrounded by the millions who will be called with him to fight and die for the defense and honor of our country. Never had I heard such sublime words. Never had I seen a human face so solemn and so prophet-like as the face of the President when uttering these things. I was beside myself, bathed in tears. I tried to say something, but I could not utter a word. I knew the hour to leave had come. I asked from the President permission to fall on my knees and pray with him that his life might be spared, and he knelt with me. But I prayed more with tears and sobs than with words. Then I pressed his hand on my lips and bathed it with my tears, and with a heart filled with an unspeakable desolation, I bade him adieu. It was for the last time. The hour was fast approaching when he was to fall by the hands of a Jesuit assassin for his nation's sake.